experience that Jesus prepared Peter for, which is the concept that, and certainly that is not the only text as we looked at it, really it's an identical concept that Nehemiah, the Kohathite Levite, speak of Abraham in Nehemiah, and that is that in preparation for covenant or release or ministry, there will be specific trial, and that the trial is never irrelevant to that release. In fact, generally, the nature of the trial has something to say both as to what the usefulness or release will be. In Peter's case, as we saw, and as we now can see, we have that beautiful, wonderful vision of hindsight. You know, Peter didn't have that the night when Jesus put his arm around him and said, look, I'm going to pray for you, but you're going to be going through a real experience here, and best I can do is pray that your faith won't utterly fail you. I mean, that was such a positive statement. Wouldn't you love the Lord to put his arm around you and say, you're about to really go through something, and I'm going to pray for you, and about the most successful prayer I can hope to pray is that your faith will not utterly fail in the process of this. I mean, that's such an encouraging affirmation, don't you think? But as we now look from hindsight, we see Peter's two letters, which are persecution literature, the chief persecution literature in the New Testament, are directly related to the kind of test that he was to go through. The test, incidentally, was not, as some people tell you, simply the identity issue of denying the Lord three times and so forth. Because if you follow the Petrine experience of test, you will see that beginning from that night on, it goes through the resurrection into the appearance of Jesus in John 21, and the first verses there of the 21st chapter of John tell you Peter's state of mind, which was an intense depression. And the test of Peter involved more than just the failure, but as I said to you yesterday about Abraham, it is the response to that failure. How do you go on? What do you do? Now, buddy, I'm going to tell you, it may not be popular, I said it Sunday morning, and some people took issue with me, and that's great, because it's a fact, it's true, and they'll discover it too, and that is, we in America particularly prepare people for success when what we ought to be doing is training people for failure. Now, I didn't say training people to fail. I mean, you do very well at that without any training. But training you how to handle failure is what I'm saying. And instead, our whole mentality is to prepare you to handle success, which on a percentage basis is a small part of what happens in your life experience. How do you handle failure? And of course, the revelation that's given in the 21st chapter of John concerning the Petrine experience, by the way, I have a favorite message I love to preach from John 21 on depression. And I especially love to preach that when I'm asked to go to a charismatic clinic. I just really love to get up in one of those hoopy sessions and say, my topic tonight is depression. It just has this marvelous effect across the, you know, you just kind of hear this general, kind of moan. But the truth is that the experience of John 21 in showing how Jesus dealt with Peter in that intense depression by helping him to achieve a success in what he was most related to, which of course was fishing, by preparing food for him, by leading him back to the issue of his failure, and three times bringing restoration as he had three times experienced the failure. And there are so many other things in John 21 that are important. The place of the others in depression. It's an incredibly important issue. Peter was so depressed that he didn't even recognize the Lord. It had to be John who would say to him, Peter, it is the Lord. And I guarantee you, A believer in depression does not understand that the Lord is coming to them in that experience. They must have those who stand with them and who can say to them, dear beloved Christian friend, it is the Lord who is with you in this experience, and who is trying to manifest himself to you in a different way than he has manifested himself to you before. And of course, it was obviously a different manifestation because they thought it was a ghost, or at least they certainly weren't convinced it wasn't a ghost, or didn't recognize the Lord in his form. And I think that most of us have a very monolithic perspective of Christ. We only see Jesus flying in somewhat like Superman, and the evangelical world really has a Jesus figure with a big ass who flies in at the right moments and bails us out and lifts us out of circumstances. And it's just incredibly difficult for us to perceive the variety of ways in which God manifests himself to us. And especially, and I'm going to say this to you just right up front, this idea that depression is somehow demonic possession, and if you cast out enough demons, you're going to be out of depression, is not only foolish, it's unbiblical. Generally, the people who experience depression as believers are the most sincere believers. And they are generally the most creative people. I mean, some people are just dull enough that they don't get depressed. They don't get anything. I mean, they don't experience anything at deep levels. They you know, it's kind of like a heart machine that runs when a person dies. You know, the heart machine just goes zzz, like that. That's the death signal. If the heart's pumping, the signal is like this, right? And death is even. Well, that's about the way it is. Some people are just, they don't experience anything deeply. I mean, they're the kind of people I talked about the other day, who the man said to his wife, when she asked why he hadn't said, I love you in 13 years, he just said, I told you 13 years ago and I haven't changed my mind. You know, well, that's about the level some people experience life. They're not liable to be oriented towards depression, because life is a very even keel thing in their experience. But generally, the more creative a person is, and often the more spiritually oriented he is or she is, the more that person will be given to depression experiences. Of course, the key case in point is Elijah. Now, this is not in my notes, and I don't have the foggiest idea why we're doing this, but it's just so much fun. Let's stay on it. When does depression generally come in our lives? Generally following great spiritual victories. See, the greater the spiritual victory, generally, the greater the depression. In fact, you can predict depression will set in after a great Bible conference or after a crossroads or whatever else. You know, after you've just been sailing in spiritual heights with angels and superpowers, the almost next scheduled event on the calendar of heaven for you will probably be touching the bottom, just like you've been touching the top. And again, those of you who fly higher always fly lower too. It's just predictable, you know. The high flyers are the low flyers. And in Elijah's case, of course, here's the guy who has 500 prophets of Baal killed and calls fire from heaven and so forth, and a few minutes later, a 98-pound Jezebel says, I'm going to get you, buddy. And he takes off running, ends up under a juniper tree and says, oh God, I'm no good. My father was never good. Why don't you kill me? You know, I mean, it's an incredible turn of events. And you want to look at this guy and say, are you the same guy I saw on Mount Carmel a few moments ago? You know, what's happened to you? But do you notice how God deals with him? God doesn't send down an angel, chide him, say, where's your faith, idiot? Don't you know to confess only positive things? What are you doing? No, God says, I know what you need, and he puts him to sleep. And after he's asleep, he wakes him up and feeds him with special bread baked in heaven and puts him to sleep again and wakes him up again and feeds him. And only after the process of restoration through dealing with the physical need does he respond in any way to dealing with Elijah's spiritual need at that point. And of course, Elijah was in a spiritual pride position, thinking he was alone in this whole spiritual conflict. And God said, look, you're never alone. I got 7,000 who haven't bowed their knee to Baal, so get off your little pout, get up, and let's get on with the job of turning this nation around. Depression's a very real issue. So the Tatrine trial that we talked about, being turned around in a revolution, in a vortex, and that when he had been in that vortex, that he would be able to deal with his brethren in similar circumstances. He would be known as one who would strengthen brethren in persecution. That's exactly what Jesus was saying. Because of your trial of faith, your key message will be to strengthen your brethren in similar trials. And that's exactly what his key message was. But you see, we're taught to deny our weakness. And if a minister has a depression experience, the quicker he's out of it and can bury it, and the fewer people he meets who reminds him of it, the better off he feels. And so it is with most experiences. A lot of the so-called faith teachers, when they need an operation, they sneak off and have it. And that's not facetious. I have a very close medical friend in the South who's performed major surgeries on two of the major faith teachers. But what an absolute anathema to the message of the cross that we would have to play some kind of game about our weakness when the Word says it is out of our weakness that His strength is made perfect. So what we deny is the opportunity for God to show His glory through us by surrendering the areas of our weakness to Him. If in this room, suddenly this could become New Testament Christianity instead of 20th century churchianity, if this were true New Testament Christianity, we would be free to stand up among our brethren and say, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really struggling. I'm a believer. I love Jesus Christ with all my heart. But I'm really facing an intense battle. I haven't had a problem with this for a month, but I'm facing an intense battle with this right now. Or I have homosexual tendencies. Or my marriage is a mess. We're here at Crossroads, but the only thing that's keeping us together is a small room. Now that's Christianity that can be redemptive and healing. But see, we don't practice that. We even talk about our Sunday go-to-meeting clothes. We even have to have special dress, special attitude. You know, Sunday mornings, I believe, are uniquely the worst days in the world. Sunday morning, you get up, you got to go to church. Nobody wants to go to church. It's the one day to sleep in, but you get up and you burn the toast and you kick the dog and you scream at the kids and you're not talking to your husband or wife. You get in the car and you drive silently to church in a silence that you could cut with a knife, and you open the door and you say to the man beside you, good morning, brother. Isn't it a beautiful Lord's Day? It's a wonderful God doesn't strike us dead. It's a wonder the parking lots of churches aren't filled with potholes of lightning where God is just eliminated. But that's exactly a revelation of where we are. That somehow in the church, before other Christians, we are to show our, quote, best side. When New Testament experience is just the opposite. We show our best side to the world. We show our need to the church. And that's where we are healed in order to show our best side to the world. But instead, we play the game the exact opposite way. In fact, I'll guarantee you, some of you in this very room, have friends in the world that you can be more honest with about your weaknesses than you do people in the church. And you feel like you can talk to them. They're not holding you up to some expectation. And you can say to them, I'm really struggling here, and they listen to you and they understand because they're not putting a trip on you. But you feel to say the same thing to a brother or sister, it would be a matter of days until that would be all around the church. Everybody else would know, do you know so-and-so has this problem? I spoke to someone last evening who shared something with me and then said, is it necessary for you to share this with anyone else? I said, are you kidding? I would never share something like that with someone else. I couldn't beat it out of him. What do you mean, is it necessary for me to share this? And then she shared with me an experience that she had had that made her say what she had just said. We model that in our denominational circles. One of my best friends, one of the most brilliant men I ever knew, who was appointed to a major denominational position, went into a denominational leader as a friend to tell him something that was going on in his life. As a result, that denominational leader pulled him out of his position, said, I am duty bound. See, even the Catholics know better than that. The Catholics know that we wear two hats, one as a confessor and one as an administrator. And if you come to me in the Catholic tradition and you say, I want to say something to you, I take off my administration cap and I put on my confessor's cap, and what is said, nothing ever goes out of that room. My administration part doesn't even know what you've said to me as a confessor. And that's the true Christian perspective. We respond to each other in that response. The great tragedy of the Protestant church is we don't have a confession. I'm always amused at translators, how the evangelical church has allowed translators, translators consistently have handled truths in scriptures based on their particular denominational prejudice. My brother here, who's a scholar in the languages, which I certainly am not, will tell you as I do. I can pick up any translation of the New Testament and tell you the prejudice of the translator. And I can tell you by their footnotes. Because in their footnotes they'll say, well, there's another manuscript that reads this way on the subject. The fact is, if you wanted to do that, you'd have to footnote every verse in the whole Bible, practically. And the fact that they call attention to a particular divergence is obviously their prejudice. You can read it. You can just read through the footnotes and tell where a man's coming in reference to that prejudice. You and I need to understand something about this whole context of purity in our Christian experience. That it is not a sinless perfection, but it is an integrity of honesty. And as a result of that, the greatest impurity before God is phoniness and hypocrisy. One reason people like the King James is they don't understand the words. And one of the words in the King James that appears over and over again, and it's not handled very well in most of the new translations either, is the word dissimulation. It is the ultimate charge against anyone in the Christian church. Even the Apostle Peter was guilty of dissimulation, and Paul stood him up in front of the whole church in Antioch and said, you're a phony. You ate with us and enjoyed us before the Jews came, and the minute they came and put a trip on you, you withdrew. That's phony. That's not a part of the Christian message. Dissimulation. Hypocrisy. The greatest gift and quality that God asks from you is the integrity of honesty. And that's why many times people that we think are far away from God in terms of not meeting our moral expectations really have a greater intimacy with the Lord in many ways than some of us do. I spoke last evening again on the Philippians 3rd passage of what true spirituality is in the Christian church. And true spirituality manifests itself on two bases. First of all, a total rejection of works orientation, which means I stand only in the righteousness of Christ, and thereby, on that righteousness, I can enter intimacy. No one from legalism ever enters intimacy with the Lord. It is impossible. It is impossible. It's like trying to be intimate with a person through works orientation. See, some of you have tried that too. Some of you have tried to win the favor of father and mother by works. You've tried to win the favor of husband and wife by works. It's impossible. It is a mutually exclusive path. Works and intimacy are mutually exclusive. They will never, never meet. They are like divergent points that go like this. And that's why Paul would say, in Philippians chapter 3, if I could be one, If I could win God's favor by works, and he's already given his pedigree, and there's no one in this room will ever have a pedigree like Paul who could say, touching the law, I'm blameless, and concerning zeal, persecuting the church. But he says, if it were possible to stand before God on works, I would reject it. I want to be found only in the righteousness of God by faith, because I want intimacy. I want to know him. And to know him in intimacy requires that kind of a stand with God. Well, we haven't said a word yet about notes, so let's get back to target, shall we? Today we enter the third basic area of our discussion, and of course the obviously the more detailed issue. We are seeing that there are not only three sources of the problems, and the three sources we looked at, of course, using the little football player as an illustration, the three sources are the coach himself and his own body's lack of response to the discipline that's required, the internal conflict within his natures, and then Satan, who wants to deride or detract him from the ultimate place. But there are equally three arenas in which the problems occur. Now, I'm using the word arenas here in the sense of areas in which, or types of, the conflicts. Large, defined areas in which all conflicts occur. And the Bible clearly teaches that there are three of these. In other words, everything that's going to happen within the Christian context of problem is going to fall into one of these three larger categories. And I think most of you could give it to me very quickly. The categories are the world, the flesh, and the devil. Now, these three categories of problems are so very critical to understand, because what happens with an understanding of this, well, let me say it negatively, what happens without an understanding of this in most Christian lives is that we tend to put the problem areas all in category three. They are all in the arena of satanic involvement, satanic opposition of the devil. When, in fact, at least two-thirds of the problems are in another arena. The influence of the enemy may be obvious in these areas, in each of the areas, of course, and his headship and lordship over those areas is obvious, but the battle becomes more real when we see it as more personal and less supernatural. Now, each of these has a battleground. In other words, you can predict where the battle will come in reference to you. Battles with the world occur in the battleground, or basically occur in the battleground of the mind. The flesh finds its primary battleground in two. It divides into two, and the Bible's clear about this, and that is the body, or the actual physical body, and the human spirit. Those become the two battlegrounds in reference to the flesh. And of course, the issue of the devil, as we've already seen, is the issue of our life, or its effectiveness. And generally, of course, among believers, we're talking about our ministry or our purpose. So the battleground is in the area of philosophy. It's in the area of life goal. It's in the area of achievement and purpose. Now, interestingly enough, these three battlegrounds, or these three issues, have exact bipolar contrasts biblically. The contrast with the world is the Word of God and the will of the Father, as we will see. Those are the two issues that are at stake. The opposite to the flesh arena is the Holy Spirit. And constantly those two are being contrasted, flesh, spirit. And the opposite to the devil, of course, is the issue of lordship. And it is the actual servanthood or surrender to the lordship of Jesus Christ, because again, the battleground is purpose. So you see, the issue is surrender, obedience to the purpose through the lordship of Christ, or being sidetracked in the arena of Satan's effort to keep you from that. Now there's one other thing that we need to say at this point, and that is that the Bible gives us three heroes in this field. I don't know of any other place in the Bible in which God singles out three men. Now, there are many heroes of faith. The 11th chapter of Hebrews names a whole heroic museum, some of which are named specifically, others which are just described in terms of their events or their heroics. But in one place in the Bible, God names three men and says, look, these three men became unique examples of this strategic fight. And the passage is Ezekiel 14, and the godly victors that are named are Noah, Daniel, and Job. Now, when you think of those three men, immediately you understand why they are unique victors. For their battles were very, how shall I say, dramatic. They were very pictorial. They were very cinematographic. Noah's battle was a direct confrontation with the world system. Any question about that? I mean, most dramatic confrontation with the world system in the history of the world was the battle between Noah and the world system. Daniel. Now notice that. That's a strong statement. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Boy, we better understand what we're talking about if it's that strongly felt by God. Okay, next. Okay, that's a really interesting one because it defines it in three ways: lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Very interesting. Okay. Okay. Can I just stop a moment because lust is appearing so often in these verses? Evangelicals have a really interesting thing about that word lust. I just need to tell you something to straighten you out. It means inordinate affections. And very seldom does it have a physical connotation. It does occasionally. But in most instances, it does not. It means to be inordinately affectioned towards something. Okay. I need our brother to read the scripture he just read again, because I need you to hear something. This is concerning those who were with you but were not of you. Would you read that one more time? Yes. Well, you need to know he's talking about people in the church.
but their mentality is from the world, and thus the world is attracted to what they say. Very interesting. All right, sister here. Are you seeing the difference coming through? I mean, one time the world's being saved, another time the world's the greatest enemy, and if you love it, you can't love the Father. I mean, something's happening with this word that we better understand. Okay. As he is, so are we in this world. Now, we've just been told not to be in the world, because if we're in the world, the love of the Father is in us, and here we're told that we are in the world as he was in the world. Okay? That's why these people are destined to be Bible teachers, because you just listen to them by nature, right? The accent just... He'd be a wonderful success in America, even if he had nothing to say. He just people would come just to hear. That's right. God bless you. I need to stop at this point because I need to tell you something. Who is the overcomer here? See, you and I are told overcomers are people who read the Bible a certain amount of times. So who is the overcomer? The one who believes that Jesus Christ, Son of God. We're all in that category if we're believers. Now, where did we go next? I've forgotten. Over here, brother. God bless you. When we were children, we were in slavery to the basic principles of the world. Now that is one of the key verses of understanding. I just want you to put that in your heart. Something about the world system has to do with childish enslavement, the things that children tend to think about. But just kind of put that away in your mind for a moment. All right, next.